And welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, July 16th, 2020. Here are some of your headlines. Another daily record of confirmed coronavirus cases in the U.S., over 75,000. And fatalities from the pandemic also reaching new highs this week. As states continue to struggle over how fast to reopen their economies and some having to pull back. We'll get an update from Dr. Anthony Fauci, the federal government's top infectious disease expert. Two former chairs of the Federal Reserve who served under presidents of different parties, Janet Yellen and Ben Bernanke, testifying before a House subcommittee about the next coronavirus economic relief bill, both calling for aid to the states and an extension of increased unemployment benefits. The Pentagon bans the display of the Confederate flag on military installations, but the memo from the Defense Secretary Mark Esper does not say the word flag or ban. Instead, it lists the types of flags that can be flown and does not have the Confederate battle emblem on that list. And Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg says she is receiving chemotherapy for a recurrence of cancer but has no plans to retire. In a statement, the 87-year-old said, "I have often said I would remain a member of the court as long as I can do the job full steam. I remain fully able to do that." And we begin with a battle over face masks in Georgia. The governor there, Brian Kemp, a Republican, filing a lawsuit to stop Atlanta and other local jurisdictions from enacting mandatory mask laws. The governor defended his position at a news conference at the state capitol building in Atlanta today.
"I don't believe Georgians need a mandate to do the right thing. You know, Dr. Toomey and I have been on the road for the last 2 weeks encouraging Georgians to wear a mask where they can't socially distance when they go out in public. But also have been telling local elected officials that we've had current orders that have been on the books for months now that worked before, they'll work now, we just need to enforce them. But this is not about masks. We all agree it's good to wear a mask in the right situation. This is about protecting the livelihoods of our citizens. I was told this morning that California's unemployment rate is 17.5%. Ours is 7.5%. You can check my numbers to make sure I'm right, but I'm pretty sure it's in that ballpark. That is because we are fighting two battles, and we continue to fight 24/7 with this whole team over here to protect the lives of our citizens. And we have done that before. Albany, Georgia is a great example. That community embraced the guidance that they were getting without mandates and flattened the curve. And they did what I'm asking people to do now, and that's encourage people to wear a mask. And we sent masks down there weeks ago for them to hand out to their citizens. We need our citizens to be the solution to the problem that we're facing right now. And they have my commitment that I will stand every single day to make sure that we have the resources we need in our state, from hospitalizations, from PPE, and other things, to make that happen."
"Good morning, Governor. Thanks for answering our questions today. You said a minute ago that you thought Mayor Bottoms was playing politics with her mask mandate. Are you the one playing politics, and what does the lawsuit say about your priorities given the rise in the COVID numbers?"
"Well, my priority with the rise in cases has been very clear for weeks now. You know, if you look back of what happened and when, you know, some in the media are accusing us that we reopened too fast. We were open for 2 months before this latest rise. And if you look at when it started, I think there's several reasons for that. Number one was the demonstrations. Number two, because of the demonstrations, that sent a message to people that, hey, it's all right to get out again. We can let our guard down. We got this thing beat, and I think we're all guilty of that. I'm not trying to point any fingers at anybody. My focus during that time was to keep our city from getting burned down and protect the protesters that were protesting peacefully as they did at the Capitol, and we worked with those groups to do that. But this is about the lives and livelihoods of all Georgians."
Georgia Governor Brian Kemp at a press conference in Atlanta. He is a Republican, and the mayor of Atlanta, Democrat Keisha Lance Bottoms, defended her mask requirement during an interview on NBC's Today Show.
The entire this filing of a lawsuit is simply bizarre, quite frankly. Savannah and Mayor Johnson instituted their mask order at the 1st of July. The governor's hometown of Athens, Georgia, instituted a mask order on the 8th of July. And then when Atlanta instituted a mask order, and I did it via executive order, he filed a lawsuit. And in addition to filing this suit based on the mask mandate, he takes exception with some advisory business reopening recommendations that were made by the city. He is suing us personally, myself and the city council, because of those advisory recommendations. And it, I don't think it happenstance that this lawsuit came the day after Donald Trump visited Atlanta, and I pointed out that he was violating city law by not having on a mask at Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport. And so there are several mayors across the state who joined me in being perplexed by the governor's actions, and we will continue to do what we need to do on behalf of the people we've been elected to represent.
Well, don't sugarcoat it. I mean, you think that the governor is motivated by politics or doing this at the bidding of the president because someone remarked that the president violated Atlanta's order by not wearing a mask when he was at the airport?
I absolutely do. I think that he is putting politics over people.
Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms on NBC this morning. At least 15 local municipalities around Georgia have issued mask mandates, which are now on hold pending the outcome of the governor's lawsuit. In Illinois today, Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker, along with the state health director and the state superintendent, filed their own lawsuit. It's aimed at requiring face coverings in schools. Across the country, confirmed coronavirus cases are now over 3.5 million, deaths over 138,000. An assessment of where we are from Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases.
Well, we're in obviously a difficult situation. We have now a very large outbreak. There have been, as you probably know, close to 140,000 deaths, and we have several million infections. That's the sobering news. There are some bright spots that we need to capitalize on, namely areas of the country like the New York metropolitan area, which have actually been through a very, very difficult time, probably worse than any other regional area of a big city in the world, but have turned it around and come down. But as we're seeing now, if you follow the news carefully, which is pretty obvious, that there are sections of the country, particularly a group of southern states, particularly California, Florida, Texas, and Arizona, as well as others, that are seeing a resurgence where we're seeing where we had a baseline of about 20,000 cases a day has now gone up to 30, 40, 50, 60, and even 70 on the last count. So we've got to do something about that. That's something we need to address. It is a significant issue. Resurgences are things that we've got to be able to suppress because, as we all know, we want to ultimately, and as soon as we possibly can, and as safely as we possibly can, we want to reopen the country, get it back to some step-by-step direction towards normality. And the way you do that is by a careful process of opening up under certain types of guidelines that we have put out from the coronavirus White House task force. So those are the kind of things that we're trying to get back in step. I mean, I think the time has come that we really do need to take a look at what's going on and see if we can intensify the things we do to prevent the resurgences that we're seeing.
Dr. Anthony Fauci from the National Institutes of Health during a virtual conversation today hosted by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. CNN reports an unpublished document prepared for the White House Coronavirus Task Force and obtained by the Center for Public Integrity, a nonprofit newsroom, recommends that 18 states in the coronavirus red zone for cases should roll back reopening measures amid surging cases. Among the recommendations, residents should wear a mask at all times outside the home and maintain physical distance. Some serious negotiations expected next week on the coronavirus economic relief package that will come before Congress, expected before the end of the month. It would be the fourth stimulus package to be considered by Congress. The Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin telling a House Small Business Committee today what the administration wants to see with the Payroll Protection Program, which gave forgivable loans to businesses forced to shut down to keep paying employees. When it came to question time, the chair of the committee, Democrat Nydia Velazquez, asked about favoritism in the program.
Ethics rules were waived administratively in the PPP, allowing friends of the Trump administration to get access without any further review. Meanwhile, there are thousands of small businesses, many owned by women or minorities, and located in rural areas that were desperately seeking assistance. Were you concerned about those optics?
Well, let me just say, as it relates to certain loans that the administrator said, there will clearly be loans that are reviewed for appropriateness. But let me just comment on the conflict of interest rules. I had very specific discussions with Senator Schumer and McConnell on the conflicts rules. And it relates to the direct loans from Treasury and the loans from the Federal Reserve. There were very specific requirements and certifications that were required from members of Congress and the administration. As it relates to the SBA program, Congress could have included those same requirements but decided not to do so. And indeed, the SBA followed their standard provisions for the SBA. The SBA Standards Conduct Commission determined that the PPP loans should be governed by similar disaster programs. And explicitly, and again, this was a committee that did not consist of political people, explicitly decided to provide the same waivers that they've done for other programs. So again, we look forward to working with oversight committees to make sure that proper rules and regulations were followed.
Well, I welcome that, and we intend to exert our responsibility and our constitutional duty to be at the table. I am the first minority female chairing a committee, and when we are discussing lending programs that are within the jurisdiction of this committee, I will demand for the ranking member and myself to be at the table. I insisted that ethics rule should not be waived. These are lending programs. If it's good for the 7A and 504 and SBIC, it should be good for this type of lending. And I will insist on that when we sit down to discuss going forward.
Congresswoman Nydia Velazquez, Small Business Committee Chair, Democrat from New York. The ranking Republican on the committee is Steve Chabot of Ohio, and he asked Steve Mnuchin about whether some PPP loans should automatically be turned into grants without small businesses having to prove the money was spent on qualifying expenses.
Does the loan forgiveness process need to be simplified anymore? For example, I know there's some members of Congress that have suggested perhaps even forgiving all the loans under $150,000, for example. I'm not saying that we should or shouldn't do that, but I'd love to hear your kind of thoughts about it. I've heard a lot of concerns from folks out there about how complicated the forgiveness process can be. If you could talk a little about that.
Well, we look forward to working with this committee and the Senate Small Business Committee to simplify the process. There were provisions in the existing act that made it complicated. We tried to issue as much guidance as we could. I know one of the things we'll talk about is, should we just have forgiveness for all the small loans? I think that's something we should consider. We should obviously make sure there's some fraud protection, but we look forward to working with this committee and others.
Thank you. As you know, at this point, there's approximately $130 billion that's still in the PPP program. So everyone's talking about, so what do we do with that? Do we reduce the number of employees eligible from, say, 500 down to 100? Or do we stick with what we have? Do we do a second PPP? And I know these are negotiations that everyone is having now, including the administration, the House, the Senate, this committee, and others. What are your current thoughts about that?
The administration supports using the existing money and topping it up with some additional money, and that will be discussed, and allowing for a second payment to the businesses that are especially hard hit. And Chairwoman, let me just say, I was only giving examples of businesses. I didn't mean to any way imply that those are the only businesses that are hard hit. I think this time we need to have a revenue test and make sure that money is going to businesses that have significant revenue declines. That's something that Congress didn't have in the first provision. So, but make sure that the businesses that are especially hard hit, particularly small businesses, and put in certain safeguards. So some of the types of people we saw that took out loans, and I look forward to working with Congress. If Congress wants to put back in the conflict rules, we're more than happy to work with Congress. The administration supports, we will participate on the same basis of the House and the Senate.
Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin questioned by Congressman Steve Chabot during today's Small Business Committee hearing. The House passed a $3 trillion coronavirus economic relief bill 2 months ago. That has already been rejected by the Senate Republican leadership, who plans to offer their own version on Monday. White House has been saying the president wants a $1 trillion cap on spending, also wants a payroll tax cut included. And today we're learning a little bit more about what Senate Republicans will offer. It will give businesses 5 years of protection from personal injury or medical liability lawsuits related to the coronavirus pandemic. More on the economic relief package coming up in a moment on Washington Today. And welcome back to Washington Today. One big part of the talks over the next coronavirus economic relief bill is aid to states which have lost tax revenue from the economic shutdowns. Advocating for the aid today, two former chairs of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen. They testified before the House Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Crisis. Here is the subcommittee chair, Democrat James Clyburn, with Ben Bernanke.
What do you think will happen to the economy over the next few months if Congress fails to pass a new stimulus bill?
Well, I'll focus on the state and local governments part of this. They are both the first line providers of critical financial services, health, education, and the like, and they're also big employers. And one thing we learned in the after the financial crisis was that because of balanced budget requirements at the state and local level, as states and localities saw big declines in their revenues, they also had to do serious cuts in their employment and capital investment, leading to a slower economic recovery. Some recent estimates suggest that the contraction at the state and local level slowed growth in the U.S. economy after the crisis by about half a percentage point a year, which is significant. Now, this crisis has had similar effects. On the one hand, state and localities have had greater expenses to deal with the health crisis that help companies reopen safely. On the other hand, they've seen big revenue hits. One estimate is that the revenue hit for states alone since February is over $500 billion. If no action is taken to help the states and localities avoid massive contraction, then it will have a negative effect both on recovery, but also on critical services that they provide to their citizens.
Ben Bernanke and Congressman James Clyburn. The Select Subcommittee ranking Republican is Steve Scalise. He also brought up aid to the states when he questioned the other former Fed chair to testify today, Janet Yellen.
I do want to ask Dr. Yellen, because you talked about a substantial amount of money to bail out states. Do you have a rough idea of how much money you're talking about? We've already passed $150 billion to help the states get through this. Are you talking about a $500 billion number, a $1 trillion number? Can you quantify what you mean when you're talking about this package that would bail out states?
Well, as Chair Bernanke mentioned in his response to the chair's question, there is a study by the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities that suggests that I believe it's through 2022 that the shortfall for states alone is put at about $550 billion. And there's perhaps not quite as large, but also tremendous shortfalls at the local level. So I think we are talking about very substantial cutbacks. Chair Bernanke and I are both happen to be serving on state reopening committees.
And if I may, I appreciate that. I apologize. I know we're on limited time. You know, you talk about $550 billion as a starting point, not even factoring in local governments. I think we all have talked about this, but we need to recognize there were many states that, not many, there were a few states that had massive budget shortfalls, multi-billion dollar budget shortfalls prior to COVID-19. So the idea that the federal taxpayer, which is already stretched, should bail out those states that had failed policies. You can look at the tax policies I talked about earlier. Many of those states had budget shortfalls because they were taxing their people too high, and because of that, they were running the good jobs out of their state. And that's what they should be focused on fixing the problems they had prior to COVID that were causing their economies to collapse and businesses to flee and good jobs to flee. Fix that now while we're in the middle of rebuilding things. That's where the focus ought to be, so that they can come back stronger. They can come back in a more healthy position, not just continue and ask the federal taxpayer to bail out their state problems.
Congressman Steve Scalise with former Fed Chair Janet Yellen. She and Ben Bernanke, another former Fed chair, making their first appearance before a congressional panel since leaving the central bank. Millions of people out of work due to the economic shutdowns imposed by the pandemic also means loss of payroll tax revenue to the federal government. How might that affect the solvency of Social Security and the calculation of benefits? That was the subject of another House hearing today with Stephen Goss, chief actuary of the Social Security Administration.
The magnitude and duration of the effects from this pandemic on our society, the economy, and Social Security are still very uncertain. That much is what we most definitely know. The largest immediate effects for Social Security will be from reductions in employment, earnings, and payroll tax liability in the near term, as is true for all economic recessions. At this time, it appears that 2020 earnings and payroll tax liability are on track to be about 10% lower than expected in the 2020 trustees report that came out in April. Assuming we do not have a substantial second wave of cases from the virus in this fall, with substantial closure of the economy for an extended period, trust fund depletion might be advanced by no more than 1 year, from 2035 to 2034. But if substantially reduced employment extends further, then negative effects on the actual status of the combined OESA and DI trust funds could be considerably larger. So how about implications for the National Average Wage Index, the AWI, and future benefit levels, a point of significant concern? The Social Security benefit formula is designed to maintain the benefit level replacement rate, that is the ratio of your benefit to how much you typically had been earning over your career, across generations by indexing benefits to the growth in the average wage level. The AWI increased every single year from 1951 through 2008. However, due to the depth of the last recession, the AWI declined for the very first time in 2009, but by only 1.5%. having a relatively small effect on the benefit level for those becoming newly eligible for benefits in 2011. At this point, however, it is likely that a much larger decline in the AWI will occur in 2020, with effects on beneficiaries becoming newly eligible in 2022.
Stephen Goss with the Social Security Administration, testifying before a House Ways and Means Subcommittee today. Social Security says about 1 in 5 married couples depend on their benefits for at least 90% of their income in retirement. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 62, NASDAQ up 29, and S&P up 9. Commerce Department says construction of U.S. homes jumped over 17% in June as some states reopened, but the pace still lags last year after the spring's massive slowdown in building activity due to the coronavirus outbreak. White House advisor Kellyanne Conway is saying President Trump should resume his coronavirus press briefings. She tells Fox News' Fox and Friends show that her opinion is different than that of other White House staff. She says the president's approval ratings were much higher when he was out there briefing everybody on a day-to-day basis, giving people the information. After that appearance on Fox, Kellyanne Conway spoke with reporters in the White House driveway.
Alluded to the fact that there are some in this White House who are advising the president against holding these coronavirus-focused events. Are those advisors making a mistake?
I think it's important for the country to hear from President Trump, and he's not afraid to give a message of any kind, as you know. So when you ask him questions about this, he answers you. He answers you. He doesn't say, oh, wait, no. Mike, where's the vice president? And, of course, we've had the briefings at the doctors are out there all the time. Dr. Fauci was at Georgetown yesterday, the day before. He's on Facebook. He's speaking readily. And I think one of the best things NIH and CDC can do right now for the country, including the guys at the top, is really crowing about this new report that this 45-person trial by Moderna and NIH has been successful in terms of the antibody going into your bloodstreams of vaccine development, because next week, July 27th, a week or so, 10 days, July 27th, it's going to be 30,000 people. So everybody should be happy, whether you give it its due in your coverage or not. Everybody should be really pleased at information like that. And the president should be talking about it. Staffers should be talking about it. Obviously, the doctors should be talking about it. So the president's not afraid to answer any question. My whole point is his approval in the pandemic was higher when he was speaking. I don't think anybody needs to be up there for 2 hours. It could be 20 minutes, it could be 30 minutes, it could be two questions, it could be no questions, respectfully, as long as the information is being delivered.
So is it self-sabotage that he's not looking at
that? No, I wouldn't say that. No, not for him. He feels like he answers the questions. Mario?
Did other advisors tell him, hey,
I won't speak about what my colleagues say. I can only speak for myself. I don't think there need to be daily in 2 hours.
Counselor to the President Kellyanne Conway with reporters in the White House driveway. President Trump had no public events today, but much of what he has done in the past few weeks has focused on issues other than the coronavirus, including cutting regulations or stopping drug trafficking. The presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden releasing his plan on how schools should safely reopen amid the ongoing coronavirus crisis. He's calling on Congress to pass a $30 billion emergency education package.
To reopen safely, schools and child care centers need funds so that they can implement the changes they need to make to buy the protective equipment for their staffs and children, to ensure proper ventilation, to upgrade broadband technology. You know, if I were president, I'd be sending a funding bill right now to the Congress today.
As long as we have to keep learning remotely, we need to ensure students have access to broadband and other technology, no matter where they live.
Every single student should be able to access high-quality distance learning. We can't allow the pandemic to further exacerbate educational disparities that already exist in this country. We need a White House that's laser-focused on closing those gaps.
Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee, along with wife Jill Biden, on a posted video. President Trump has repeatedly said he would like all schools opened in the fall and has threatened to hold back federal funding for schools that do not comply. Defense Secretary Mark Esper issuing a new Pentagon policy that, as CNN describes it, will act as a de facto ban on the display of the Confederate flag. It deals with the display and depiction of flags on military installations. And while the policy does not specifically mention the Confederate battle emblem, that emblem is not among the flags allowed to be displayed. The Pentagon held a virtual town hall today. Defense Secretary Mark Esper was there. This was the final question. You're going to hear the answer from the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley.
Today's last video submission comes from Operations Specialist First Class Pierre, who is stationed in Italy. Let's roll it.
With all the recent events that's been going on back in the States, I had to ask myself a simple question. What does my chain of command see in me when I take off this uniform? Unfortunately, I don't have the answer to that. But what I am is unapologetically black. And with that comes a great responsibility to face challenges and adversities of preconceived notions and prejudices of how I'm supposed to act or what I'm supposed to do. It's sad to say, Racism is alive and well around the world and not just back at the States. With my experience in the Navy, although it's been a great one, I ran into some people that only judge me by the color of my skin and not by the quality of my work. As a Navy, I feel that we should continue to treat people fairly based off their character and the sum of their actions. That's how we'll continue to be the world's greatest Navy.
I'll turn this one over to the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs to comment on OS-1 Pierre's message, sir.
Well, Specialist Pierre, thanks. Those are powerful words. You asked what your chain of command would think when you take that uniform off. I can't speak for every officer and NCO out there, but you and I, you're a sailor 24/7, whether you're wearing that uniform or not. I'm a soldier 24/7, all the time, every time, no matter what. And that you are unapologetically black, that's a good thing. You should never deny who you are, no matter who you are, no matter how you identify. And you should be proud of that. Be proud of being a sailor. Be proud of being an African American. And all that's good. And remember, and this is for everyone, not just Pierre, but again, going back to the oath, going back to the idea that is America, the idea that every one of us is free and equal. Remember the words of Lincoln, that this is a nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men, and I would add all women, are created equal, period, full stop. And that's what we're about. That's what that Constitution, that's what that idea is about. And we are all free and equal. It doesn't matter where we're from. It doesn't matter the color of our skin. We're going to be judged by the content of our character, not the color of our skin, like Martin Luther King said. That is what this country is about. That's the essence of America. And that is what we in uniform are dedicated to protect and defend. That's what the Constitution's all about. And we are willing to die for those principles, for those values. And again, if we're willing to die for those principles, we ought to be willing to live for them every single day. So thanks, Specialist Pierre, for what you do and what you do every single day, whether you're wearing that uniform or not. Thanks for what you're doing and who you are.
General Mark Milley, Chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a virtual town hall held by the Pentagon. Defense Secretary Mark Esper also taking part. And Esper's memo today that effectively banned the Confederate flag on military bases did not address the issue of bases named after Confederate generals. A couple of other headlines today. The Pentagon reportedly given the White House options to reduce the U.S. troop presence in South Korea following President Trump's demands that South Korea pay significantly more to keep U.S. forces there. That report in the Wall Street Journal, there are currently 28,500 U.S. troops on the peninsula. And Congressman Justin Amash, who switched from Republican to Libertarian after calling for President Trump's impeachment, announcing he will not be seeking re-election, first elected to Congress in 2010. Thanks for joining us on Washington Today. Be sure to download the free C-SPAN Radio app to take C-SPAN Radio with you anywhere and get our podcasts. Podcasts also available at cspan.org/podcasts or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Have a good night and weekend, and we'll see you next week.